All right, guys, welcome back to another edition of the Coaches Roundtable. Been a few months. I think August, we're now in January, so a lot has probably gone on. Yeah, let's just maybe touch base and see if there's any interesting topics that come up out of that. So I guess we'll start with you, Jer, and then we'll go to you, Brandon, and we'll...
Yeah, man, it's crazy. It's been since August since we've talked. It does feel like it's been forever. I think that both, which I know I DM'd with you a little bit about this as well, but congratulations on getting married. I know since we last talked,
too,
we've both gotten married, which of course is a pretty big change. I know you guys got a dog. I'm doing your life update instead of mine. Yeah. Man, but past that, what we added a new coach to our team, Tass. She's been incredible. She's someone who was working with us and mentoring under us for a very long time. And I had been like trying to like put hints out there forever. Hey, you're ever interested in joining the team? Just shoot me the message. And she finally picked up on that. Or decided to move forward on that, which I'm so happy with. And she's done incredible so far. It's so cool to see. And we expected nothing less because, again, we've been reviewing everything she's done for so long. Again, like with her being in our mentorship as well. But she's just been crushing it. So that's been awesome. Been a super productive period of building with Brandon. Really happy with how things are going there. Been pretty jacked. I'm really stoked on the progress we're making in that regard.
Absolutely.
I feel like that's basically it for me. Not much outside of that.
Training wise, what's going on there? Just focus on building and adding weight. Anything specific there with that?
Yeah, we're just in Brandon. You can definitely jump in wherever you want as well if you want to speak to this also. But we're really just focusing on building across the board. I feel like I've seen some pretty good growth across the board as well. I feel like my mindset around this has changed a lot. I know we were talking about that on our last call, Brandon, again, like my perceived limits with all of this. And just gotten in a good routine. Man, there have been a lot of things that have changed in the last year. But I also feel like we've done a lot with, I've been always working with several coaches, Brandon being one of them, who's helped me a lot with the mental side of things. Working with another girl, Leah, who's really helped me a lot, I think, with like stress, perception of stress. And I think that even like in my most recent round of labs, we looked at where it was like my reverse T3 was so much lower than it ever been. My cortisol was in a good place. Like I can really see and feel. That's not like the only thing. I think that's like the only benefit here, but that has been a big part of it where I feel like from like a stress, sleep, I feel like just mentally there have been a lot of shifts that have really helped. So it's been a productive time. But yeah, we've just been focusing on building across the board. I'm really happy with how lower bodies come up a lot. I think I've added quite a bit to quads, but really I feel like we've added a good amount across the board.
Yeah, I definitely, to follow up, because Jeremiah won't hype himself up. So I'm going to do it for him because I'm an objective bystander in this process. But I will say that I think when he first came to me, and these were conversations that we had since the jump, we've been working together over a year and a half at this point, I didn't think he was maxed out. And I thought that he had a lot more potential. But I think a lot of times, and this is a perception many of us get into, once we get into the land of diminishing returns, essentially, we're advanced, quote unquote, it's hard to make gains. And I think a lot of times people suffer from not an actual maximum muscular potential, but more so lifestyle limitations. So it's that the potential that they have is capped by the lifestyle that they're living. And sometimes we have to restructure our mindset, our perspective on that. We've had many conversations where there was a specific instance, and this has been documented entirely on the Living Lean podcast. Like we used to do every single like week or every month an update on his fat loss phases, his mini cut phases, his recovery diet phases. We've done lean building phase updates. But one of the greatest conversations, or the one that we had the most utility, was there was a time I challenged him. He wanted to go into a maintenance phase. And I said, I'm completely on board, but I'm going to give you multiple options. This is a coaching relationship. This is a partnership, but I think you could do more. And I think that you can handle the responsibilities of your business, the upcoming marriage. I'm not saying that training needs to come first, but if you really want to make progress, you're going to have to make this a priority. And he rose to the occasion and he realized there was times in his day that he could be spending less on social media. He could allocate more time devoted towards training, putting on apps on his phone where he blocked out emails and things that were very much with intentionality, putting a time block in his day. And I do this very much so myself, where I have every single thing within my day scheduled, every single block, whether it be my meal times or scheduled, they're with alarms. You guys are going to hear alarm go off in a little bit, because I usually have a 3:30 appointment that I utilize, or I do. And so just ingraining that structure and then really pushing himself and also his perception of what he could get out of things. And so we've obviously dialed in things. And here's the big difference. A lot of times when we get on podcasts, we have to speak in generalities. So a lot of the more nuanced things that I might utilize with Jeremiah, whether that be lengthened partials or specific nutrient timing or specific supplementation that's very detail oriented. It's, listen, I'm having you do this 5-to-1 ratio of this type of carbohydrate. I want to upregulate this glucose transporter and then this 5 transporter that's going to upregulate from the fructose absorption into the gastrointestinal system and like all these little things. These are one percentage. And these are things that on a podcast, they don't really have utility. They're not going to benefit the greater good in terms of the vast majority of people, but these are one percentages. And if we can just stack those on top of each other, it's a domino effect. So 1% plus 1% plus 1%, we do 10 things that amplify dialing in his sleep, dialing in his supplementation, making sure that he's blocking and allocating a period of his day that's really able for him to intentionally go into training without any distractions, without any worrying about emailing. Making sure that when he gets done with a session, a training session, he doesn't go right back into email and into a further prolonging that sympathetic state. Let's get you into a rest and digest state. Let's do some breathing. Let's make sure you get down regulated into a parasympathetic state and you optimize your ability to digest nutrients, because we aren't what we eat. We are what we digest and absorb. There's been many things, many conversations we've had, and all these things compound. So you might think, oh, it's just one little nutrient timing thing, or it's just one added supplementation, or I've even added in stuff for cognitive enhancement for Jeremiah, like different things that a lot of people aren't going to utilize. But obviously my background comes from over a decade working in sports nutrition, 11 years coaching at this point. And then I'm very into the deep in-depths of nutrition, sport, supplementation, different adjunctive therapies or adjunctive strategies. These are things that aren't going to benefit everyone on a podcast because they wouldn't be able to utilize them. And if they don't understand the application or the physiology underlying it, it's not going to matter to them. Or not only is it not going to matter, but they're not going to do it properly. But Jeremiah has taken everything. We've had many conversations where he's taken on board my feedback. We've worked together. We've worked as a collaborative partnership. And then he's employed it and executed. That's the biggest thing. It is the underlying principle of all this, whether we look at the nutritional hierarchy or the training hierarchy or the lifestyle hierarchy, it is adherence, sustainability, and consistency. And he's been extremely consistent. And when you just consistently execute on a plan and you nail it, you get results that you're looking for. So he's expedited his rate of progress tenfold in comparison to the years prior, but it's because he's done the little things day in and day out, while also making sure that he's still nailing the big rocks. So we've picked up the big rocks, we've nailed those, and then we've picked up the sand, the pebbles, and all those little added percentages that we could. And that's really led to a physique. And I told him this in his check-in today. This is the best I've ever seen you at this body weight. This is the biggest and leanest I've ever seen you in terms of this body composition. And then the other area of that, which is something that I focus on, because I really do look towards, if you go back to the first podcast I ever did with Jeremiah, this is 3 or 4 years ago, it was a health-centric coaching model. And I really do take that as an ideology. That's why my motto behind my coaching is a healthy body is a responsive body. His lab work looks impeccable in comparison to where he came to me. Even his fasted and postprandial blood glucose is miles ahead in terms of he's in a building phase, eating a good amount of food. And it is so much better than it was even at the end of his first mini cut and fat loss phase that we ever did together. So we have seen vast improvements because he's been really diligent, really consistent, and he's worked his fucking ass off. So I commend him for doing so. And it's been honestly a pleasure to be a part of the process because I'm as excited about his progress as I am about my own. So it's great when you have those relationships with people. And I'm sure you guys can relate to this because Jeremiah, you coached Jeff for an extended period of time. So when you're really invested into a client and you have a relationship with them, you've built a trust, a transparency, communication, like you're so like entrenched into their process that you love seeing them thrive as a businessman, as a friend, as a fitness professional within the space, and then also as a physique athlete.
So for you, Jay, I got a couple questions off of that real quick, if you don't mind me jumping in here. Working, it sounds like for you, the kind of big changes were like just placing a higher priority like around your training to make sure that you're really focused for your training sessions. And then you said you also had a drop like stress and stuff like that. I'm just curious to hear what was that just from work and just not, like you said, not having as much like organization with your time or
a lot of it was my perception. I think it's more so perception of stress, and this is something I talk about a lot with clients. I imagine you guys too do as well. I mean, there was a period I think it was on the 5-year anniversary of like when I had signed up my first online client, which was like, I think it was April 14th 2023 was when that was, or not 2023, it was April 14th 2018 was when I added my first online client. So 2023 was when I started like my 5-year anniversary. And I was like looking back at the last 5 years and I was thinking about, it's crazy how this entire time I have felt like I just need to get past like the next stressful thing and then it'll be okay for me. I'll have a little bit more time or won't be quite as stressed to prioritize my physique a little bit more. And I think for a very long time, I was still like pretty on point. I would hit my macros every day. I would do my training, but it would be like with my training again, it's like, hey, I'm training in my garage gym and I'm going to go up and answer this email quick, or shit, I got to like I got to go take this call. So maybe I'm going to do like mile reps for this set instead of like just doing my straight sets, like little things like that. Or like maybe I'm going to cut my rest period short. And I might not get quite as much out of this, but I'm still getting like most of the stimulus. Or fuck, I want to take this call or finish these emails. So it's okay if I like push back the time between my like pre-workout meal and my training session a little bit more. And again, it was just interesting for me to realize like during a lot of that time, I just really hadn't enjoyed all of this all that much, right? Where it's, man, this is something that should be fun. Like the physique development side of things, I know that I love that, but I had to let myself turn it into something that I didn't enjoy as much because I can enjoy this more in the future when I get past this. But it's like, is that really ever going to change? As long as I'm in business, it's probably always going to seem like there's something stressful coming up. And man, there's truly like a ton of work that I have done here. Again, like a start of the year, like this was one thing that started 2023. This was one thing that I really wanted to focus on. I started out working with a therapist, and then again, Leah replaced her. But I've worked through a ton in this regard, just like as a whole, like the reasoning behind why I'm doing things, right? Is like my driver, because I'm scared, which it has been for a long time. Like, am I scared I'm not going to be good enough? Am I scared of losing what I have? I'm like trying to shift from that to here's what I'm excited about in the future. Excited about where I'm going, like how I can help the people around me. And and I've talked about like the stuff with Brandon quite a bit, I think in bits and pieces, but there have just been like so many little shifts like that, where I think as a whole is just being in a better headspace. I am for sure more organized with, again, like I always block out social media, Gmail, Slack, everything like that when I'm training. I'm more organized with everything that I'm doing there, better boundaries. But also, again, I think it's just like my perception of it as, again, much more focusing on like with the physique side of things, but also the business, right? Again, like not just shit, I'm scared I'm going to lose this, or it coming from a place of like abundance. I know this sounds good, a place of abundance rather than scarcity. Really, that's been a big part of what has helped. I forgot the initial question though.
Yeah, you basically answered it there, how you worked on reducing your stress and stuff like that. Yeah. So from a training perspective, how do you set that up now? What does that look like for you? You like training like certain time of day or?
Yeah, I'll have that blocked out on my calendar, and I'll try to block out an extra like 45 minutes to an hour, honestly, to make sure that I have plenty of time for that, plenty of time for my post-workout meal and whatnot. So then like my whole week is set up around that. My calls I'm not having people booking calls when I normally train. So shit, I got to try to squeeze this in an hour. Honestly, going to a gym, I built out that whole garage gym, and then going to a gym has honestly helped a lot as well. Just being separate from it. I love the gym I train at too. They have incredible equipment. He also just told me he has 30 more pieces that are just sitting there. He just needs to get a bigger space. And I'm so stoked for that because that gym is incredible. It's all Prime and Atlanta stuff. But man, just being in a different environment, not being like in my home where I work all day, and this is just like popping downstairs to train. I feel like it just allows me to flip a switch, and I don't feel like I'm in work mode as much. And again, like I think there's something too, like, I think this can also go too far. Like Brandon, and I know you and I were DMing about, like, we can easily get too focused on just doing what's fun and enjoyable in our training and not make progress. I'm stoked on how I'm progressing right now, but I know this can, I think this is a fine line. But again, I think it just allows it to be more so this is fun for me. And I really remember how much I enjoy this. I'm stoked about progressing. I'm stoked about getting more jacked. Again, rather than it necessarily just like, I'm scared that I'm not going to progress, or I'm scared I won't have a good enough physique. Does that make sense? Just like, again, like separating it from my home has been pretty helpful as well.
Yeah, no, I can see that for sure. So you don't train at home at all anymore.
I got one session in until we get my leg press that I have at my garage. I just love. But we are actually, I was talking to the gym owner about this, such a good dude, also named Brandon. We're actually going to move my leg press from my garage to the gym. Oh, he was down for that as well. Dude,
that was the funniest part of your check-in this week, my man. I was literally dying when I read that.
That Cybex squat press is just such a good stimulus though.
So you're making me rethink getting some equipment for at home based on this, right? Because I feel like I'm in the same boat where it's like, you just end up like, at some point it's like, now you have everything at home. And then it's like, how do you separate yourself? And then like, we're talking about the dog. So watching the dog too, periods of time, I have to like go out and work in the living room. And it's like, that's where I like to hang out. So it's like, sometimes I just feel like lately, like it's just been hard to separate. And so I could see where I totally could understand how if you work out from home too, then it's like, now you're never like getting out of there and stuff like that.
Yeah, man. I went pretty hard on the gym equipment for the garage gym too. And now I feel like it's like a, It's like a relationship where it's, man, like we had such good times together and I don't like, want to let it go because of that. But then it's also, I don't even know if it's like best for my mental health. I don't enjoy training as much out there. So yeah, I don't know. I can't say I'm glad that I did it, but I can't decide if I'm going to hang on to it or not myself.
Do you ever find yourself like shooting like exercise videos or anything out there, or do you not even use it for that really?
Honestly, not a lot as of now. I for sure could in the future, but not a lot now.
Cool. Yeah, man, I definitely think you definitely look the most jacked that I've seen since I've known you. That's awesome to see, man. Just curious to see what you've been doing there. Keep it up. Brandon, what about you, man? What's going on with you?
Yeah, man, it's been a long time since all three of us have been on this. In the last few months, I know that I've spoken with this on a podcast with Jeremiah, but I don't actually, you know what, Jeff, you and I did a series. So I definitely did cover, I did a mini cut, things of that sort. So I'm currently 8 weeks into a building phase. And essentially, really, the goal of this is just to get to most muscular I've been in a couple of years. Ever since I had that car accident in 2020, I really haven't pushed my body to my body weight or just my body in a way that I have in the past, especially when I was competitive. And so really the goal of this phase, I'm 8 weeks into it. I'm gaining at approximately 1% rate of gain per month, which just honestly, both anecdotally, we look at the research as well, which we'll cover later on in this podcast, but that seems to be the best and most conducive rate of gain for someone at my level of advancement. I'm 18 years into training. It's not like shooting for like this super bulk or this perma bulk or this advanced rate of gain is going to be conducive in terms of actually developing my physique. And on the training side, this is actually something Jeremiah and I are covering. And that's why he alluded to the fact that we can't always train in the way that we want to. We can't always train for enjoyment. So I've really, the last couple of years, I've trained in a way that I really preferred, in a manner that was fun for me. It was quick sessions. I was probably training 5 days per week, an hour a session. But really, I know that the place that I've been previously, I was quite competitive in bodybuilding at one point for men's physique. I was a lot larger than I am now. And I am the type of person that I can sustain a lot of punishment in the gym, do a lot of volume. I have a pretty good recovery system, but I was really allocating more of my time resources and also my mental resources towards my business, which is still a high priority to me. But I was talking to Jeremiah about this recently, that I've had to switch back to a system that works better for me. And I might not like in terms of a training system. I'll go into what I'm doing currently. It's a little bit unconventional, but it is something that has worked for me in the past. I have a lot of data on it, and I know that it's going to allow me to get more effective volume across the course of the week. So essentially what I'm doing is I'm running a bit of a unique split. I'm actually doing a full body training split, which at one time was very popular. And this was something I started running in around 2015. And how I have it is it's a 6-day full body split. And it's really allowing me to get much more volume. Like I was alluding to last couple of years previous to this phase, I was training about 5 days per week, an hour a session. Now I'm up to 6 days per week and 90 minutes a session at least. So I'm doing a considerable amount more work. And I know that's what works best for me based on all the data that I have on myself. And then also how I've even seen my body respond in these last 8 weeks. And so essentially how I have it allocated, like when people think full body, they think you're training literally your entire body every single day. And for some people, they do that. But how I approach this is I do it on a pull or a push and pull rotation, essentially. So on sessions 1, 3, and 5, I'm hitting my pushing muscles. So that's going to include my chest, my deltoids, my triceps, and my quadriceps. And then on sessions 2, 4, and 6, I'm hitting my pulling muscles. So that's going to be my back, my rear delts, my biceps, and my hamstrings. And this allows me, honestly, to get a good amount of volume, but also recover in between these sessions. And so really the goal over the next few months is really just to push myself and drive my training performance as much as possible. I'm even having a competition with Jeremiah, who called me out on an incline press, which is not going to get me on that. I'm letting you know, I'm starting to get those neural gains. I stepped away from incline pressing under Smith for a couple of years, but Jeremiah's been making some impressive gains. I believe that when we first started working together, he was working with like a working weight around 185 for sets of 5 or 6. And now he sent me a video like a couple weeks, like 2 weeks ago, which he called me out and said he was going to beat my PR on this. And he did 230 for 6 reps.
Bro.
No, 230. We have to take the 45 off. It's a Smith machine. All right. So if we're doing it
it would have been 230 without.
Okay. So I'm utilizing the wrong metrics. But if you were to consider the Smith machine, which I don't, 45 pounds, that would be 275. So we're talking 2 45-pound plates on each side and 25. I count that 230. We can say 275. Just for ease of access.
275 there.
Yeah, we'll do 275. But I just did it. Jeremiah, I didn't get to tell you this because I was looking at it in your check-in and I forgot to mention it. But I hit it for 9 this week. I'm already starting to make those neural gains.
All right.
The second week back to it, so I'm going to be pushing. But really, the goal is going to be the next couple of months to really, I believe in progressive overload in all aspects of life. So that's going to apply to my training. That's going to apply to my approach to nutrition. So I like to pair both my nutrition and training and progress both of them over the course of time. So I'll probably escalate my volume very sequentially over time as well. as titrating up my calories. And then I will be really trying to push for as much progression as possible to maximize my ability to gain muscle, because that's been something that I put on the back burner. I'm able to stay quite lean and in good shape, but I'm not at my maximum potential by any means. So I'm going to try to do essentially a lean gains phase and try to see how well I can progress my physique over the next couple months. Right now, I'm going to post. So this will already be, this post will already be up by the time that you guys see this. We're recording this on January 24th. So tomorrow I'll be putting up a physique update and you guys will see probably the best shape I've been in a couple of years in terms of just size, development, fullness, but I'm also staying quite lean. So I'm going to try to keep that for the next couple of months and see how everything turns out. But besides that, everything's going well on the business end. The one thing I am doing, which this should actually be released by the time that we're having this, is I'm getting ready. Actually, I'm putting together as we speak a presentation for a charity seminar, which I'm going to be speaking at, which is going to take place at the Iron Health Strength and Conditioning Facility, which is a gym in Nashville. Jeff's been there. Jeremiah is supposed to be coming down to see me at that. So I'm looking forward to that. And that's going to be on February 9th and 10th, where I'm going to be covering all aspects of nutrition for muscle gain. And what's really cool about the seminar, I've done a lot over the years with a previous seminar circuit that, you know, both of you guys have attended, but this is actually just a full charity seminar. So 100% of the proceeds are going to the Vanderbilt Children's Hospital. So I'm paying my own dime. Every presenter that's coming is paying their own way there. We're really just trying to do something for the community, for the Children's Hospital. And what's even cooler about this is we really want to make it an interactive experience. So it's a 2-day seminar. We're also going to have meet and greet the night before the seminar starts. So on Thursday night, we'll have a little get together. It's most people will say, oh, let's go for drinks, but we're a bunch of fitness people. So let's be real. It's probably going to be like a taco night and like some protein powder, but we're going to have that getting all going on. And then we're going to have a 2-day seminar and the tickets are substantially reduced. So for instance, most of the seminars that you guys are going to see on the circuit, they're anywhere between $500 to $1,000 for a 2-day seminar. These are literally $105. The entirety of that payment is going to go towards the Children's Hospital. So it's a really cool event. And if anyone is in the Nashville, Tennessee area or wants to make it out there, it is February 9th and 10th. And it is actually, to be honest with you, the flights are extremely inexpensive. Like people are getting like round trip flights for $100 or $150. So if you guys are in the area or want to make it out, I would love to see you guys.
Awesome. Yeah, no, it's cool to hear about that. That's super cool. You guys are doing that. And then awesome on the building phase too. Are you guys, for nutrition, do you guys track your calories? What does that look like for you guys? Or you just go off of a kind of a little laid back structure during building phase? Or yeah, what does that look like for either one of you?
I still always track basically the structure we have in place. I basically will follow a meal plan, and then what I'll have a more flexible day typically. And we right now we have like higher calorie days on that, but essentially like for me, 6 days a week will look pretty similar. And then 1 day a week is where I'll play a little bit more macro Tetris is how I've approached it. I personally think for most people, like in general year round, even if you don't track, I think that's probably pretty similar to how you approach things. And I think that it's pretty hard to maintain a good body composition if you don't have that much structure. I don't know, Brandon, what your approach is.
Yeah. So I'll be honest with you guys. I track year round. There is never a time that I don't track, and there are periods of time. And this is what I mean by that. I am so routine oriented and structured that I really try to reduce mental fatigue and decision fatigue. So what I do is every single Sunday, I do a batch cooking where I cooked the same amount, pretty much of, I literally have the same routine. So I go to Costco, I buy everything in bulk. I cook everything. I have a very efficient manner of bulk cooking stuff. So I'll have the George Foreman grill going with chicken tenderloins. I'll have my crock pot with chicken breasts in it. I will have I'll have 99% ground turkey on the stir fry. I'll have all my vegetables. I get them frozen, so they're easy. 7 minutes a batch. I throw them all in there. My sweet potatoes, my rice is in the rice cooker. And what I do every single Sunday is I will look over all my data. So Sunday morning, I take check-in photos. I cut off my head. I send them to myself. I look over my data for the week. I look over my weekly average rate of gain, as well as my weekly check-ins if I am moving. So right now I'm trying to target a monthly body weight gain of 1%. So that is coming out to average of 0.25%. Now all three of us know this, it's not going to perfectly come out to that. But as long as I'm increasing between 0.4 to 0.5 pounds per week, my nutrition is going to stay the same. That means I'm in an effective deficit. I'm in a slight calorie surplus, which would mean between 2 to 250 or 300 calories, give or take. And I'm going to keep those variables constant. So then I will make a meal plan and I'll just follow that Monday through Sunday. And I already have put everything in bulk containers. And so I have tracked every single thing, every single meal that I'm going to eat on Sunday night. And then I just repeat that day in and day out. And if I have to make swaps, whether I run out of food or I just want to increase dietary flexibility, I have every single, so I have my own template that I utilize. which it has every single meal, what the macros are for each meal. And then I also have a list of food swaps. And I already have for myself, because I utilize a lot of the same food sources, I already have the amounts that I need to literally make a swap. So they're not only in MyFitnessPal, they're also in Chronometer, so I can get more of the micronutrient data. But I also have them in a spreadsheet for myself. So I will utilize that and I just plug and play. But it's never, for me personally, I'm just going to tell you from my own experience, I understand that a lot of people like additional flexibility. That's all well and good. I don't want to have to think about this. This is a component of my life, and fitness and nutrition are immensely important components of my life. But I want what I do with my own nutrition on autopilot. I want what I do with my own training on autopilot. I don't want to have to think about this too in depth, because I am a very over analytical individual. And that drove me nuts when I was competing. And that's why at one point I had to step away from the stage and from prepping myself, because I really wanted to focus on my clientele. So I put a lot of intentionality into my clients. And on Sunday, when I is the one day that I don't have an immense amount of check-ins, that is a day that I really devote towards my physique progress. But I make sure that I've prepped everything in advance, whether it be my food, the actual meals that I'm going to eat. And it, say, for instance, I am bored. And that's not really an emotion that I feel that often, because this is just, I'm good with executing on autopilot. This is who I am. This is what has made me successful in many aspects. I'm consistent. I show up in everything that I do. And so those things don't really bother me. But say I am sick of a food source. Then that Sunday, I sit down, I find alternative food sources. I make a list in terms of my grocery shopping list. I swap something out and then I try it. I try a different preparation method. I try different seasonings, things like that. And then I note them into my actual data sheets. Because say, for instance, I added in a new spice or something, and then I had gastrointestinal issues after meal three, that was the meal that I swapped out. I want to know that. I want to be able to isolate that variable. I'm not someone that likes to throw a bunch of shit at the wall to see what sticks. I want to isolate variables. I want to make things very efficient and effective. And also, I want to save myself time, because there are so many other, a lot of people, they become a little overly fixated with nutrition and they're playing macro Tetris every single meal and they're suffering from decision fatigue. And then what ends up happening is, and we have discussed this on many podcasts, all three of us, it's never, the person doesn't binge eat at 8 o'clock in the morning when they had their breakfast already, they had their overnight oats already set out with protein powder in them. They never overeat at that meal. It's always at the end of the day when you are fatigued from the emotions and the stress of your workday, you have nothing prepared, you have nothing in your kitchen, and then you just go for whatever is convenient. So that could be fast food, that could be Uber Eats, whatever it may be. There's so much convenient, accessible, high calorie, hyper palatable, energy dense food sources that that's where people veer off the beaten path. And then it's really hard to get back on track. I always want to make sure that I have alternatives. I have things, and I'll even go as far as I prep things way in advance, but I always have microwavable chicken in my microwavable packs of chicken that I can utilize out of my freezer. I always have frozen fruit. I always have rice cups from Costco, organic jasmine rice cups. So if anything was to go wrong, and I need to, and I'll say this objectively, if we had like a shutdown, or for instance, we had snow three times last week, I couldn't get out. It's almost like a bunker in my place. I have enough stuff that I'm going to be good for the month. So I don't want to say like the end of the world that I'm going to be stuck in New Jersey, stuck in my house. But if anything was to go wrong, I'm hyper prepared.
Yeah, biggest reason I was asking just to see how much structure you guys have with it. But I agree with you guys. You got to have some sort of structure with nutrition. And then obviously the newer you are to it, the more structure you probably need with that. And I think that's part of the art of coaching too, is walking that fine line of giving client enough structure, but then also allowing some flexibility when needed as well too. Real quick, just a general update on my training, and then we can head into the weight gain stuff. So I started building phase, things were going good. I wanted to do like a kind of focus on some specialization stuff where I just ramped up volume and on a couple muscle groups. In the first mesocycle, what I wanted to do was like lats and triceps. Things were going well, definitely focused on those things. And then in hockey, I like strained. I don't know if it was like my teres major or minor, that area, but I pushed away from somebody and I just felt this like pain real quick. And it was there for a little bit. And I tried to do a back workout the next day, and like any pulling overhead, it just was like, it was just super painful there with that. So tried to work through that. It just wasn't working. And there's like 2 weeks of it sucked, because it literally impacted the specialization stuff. So it's like, I got everything on the back burner, everything else. But then the things that I was trying to do, I just had on the back burner. So man, it was a couple like tough weeks. And this was the first injury I've had in like a long time that's kept me out of training for more than like a couple sessions. It was definitely interesting to go through that, but it made me realize like how important like training is for me. But yeah, we just basically, I tried to work through it. I worked a little bit more on the right side versus the left side, but I honestly hated that. I just felt like, I don't know, I just didn't like it. I hate it not having to go into the gym and hit my numbers and get out. Like you just feel that sense of accomplishment. And so those 2 to 3 weeks were pretty tough from a training perspective, but we switched gears to like a more chest, side delt and bicep perfect bro muscle groups specialization here in this building phase. So that's where I'm at now with that. And then we just have like triceps and lats on the back burner. Just really no overhead pulling right now, just to give it a rest. It's feeling a lot better. And then, yeah, just gaining weight. I'm at like around 160-ish. And I just really this kind of weight where I'm at, like definitely like it better than being in like the 150s where I was at the end of my fat loss phase. I just feel fuller, just better overall around this body weight. So just a general update on where I'm at there with my training.
You feel like you've been making pretty good progress. You've worked with Brian for about a year now, right?
Yeah, it's been about a year, probably a little over a year now. I think it was like October-ish or November, which is freaking crazy to think that it's already been that long a time frame on it. I think it's been good. I definitely feel like, yeah, I mean, it's been good overall. Been incorporating some pretty cool stuff, adding in a little bit more like drop set stuff. And then now we're working in a little bit higher of a rep range. So just been cool to switch that up slightly. But yeah, things are going well there with that. So just going to keep continuing to try to get jacked. You guys know how it goes. So it sounds like we're all in a building phase right now. So
same page, yeah.
Yep. Which, speaking of, I think this is probably a good time to transition to talking about weight gain and maybe just our general recommendations and things to look out for in building phase from this standpoint. And I want to tie this into Eric Helms had that new weight gain study that I think is now, I don't think it's preprint anymore. I think it's actually out now.
Officially published.
Yeah. Yeah. Just wants to touch on it. Just get your guys' thoughts on it. If it changed your mind on anything, then maybe we can just talk about our recommendations and things like that in a building phase.
Yeah, who wants to start off?
I will let one of you guys take it if you could also summarize the study, because I didn't have enough time to dig into it for this.
Yeah, no worries. I'll take this approach, and maybe I'm good to speak on this because first, I'm going to be doing a presentation that does encompass this topic in general. But also, if you guys go back, and this is a plug for both your podcasts. So if you go back to Jeremiah's podcast, I did a full series. It was a two-part series on lean gains, and I actually use that. It's called the Lean Gains Blueprint. I'm using that as my title for my next presentation. So Jeremiah,
incredible
thank you very
series,
much.
By the way, those were so good.
I appreciate it, my man. And then Jeff, I did a two-part series about 2 years ago. The anniversary just came up, and it was mistakes in a building phase. And we covered many of the mistakes. So if you guys want to go back and hear about dirty bulking or the actual science on cheat meals, things of that sort, these are just off the top of my head. Those were a couple of the concepts that you and I covered. So all three of us have went in on this topic. So I'll give you my opinion or what I've really come to from my experience with clients, but then also from the evidence. Really, I know this question was regarding weight gain, but really when I'm working with a client, my goal, I'm usually working with a client who wants to improve their body composition from a muscularity perspective. And it's not just to gain weight, but rather to focus on increasing lean mass while minimizing the fat gain. So this is especially important because many of the individuals I work with are very physique focused. So it's not like we're not just chasing scale weight gain like you may if you're a beginning trainee where you just want to see the scale go up. And this is a mistake that many of us have made in the past. So we have to realize that anyone can gain weight, especially a ton of weight, by just eating in a large surplus. And you will gain some muscle by doing so. But you're also going to gain a ton of fat in the process. And seeing as I work with mostly like intermediate or advanced trainees, like think about someone like Jeremiah, we're making lean gains because it wouldn't be conducive to put him in this massive surplus because he's already closer to his maximum potential. So that is only just going to expedite the rate of fat that he accumulates rather than the rate of lean mass that he accumulates. So what we have to realize, and this is for anyone that is past that newbie stage of training, is that once you get to the intermediate level of training, we can only gain muscle at a certain rate and we can't force feed muscle growth. So any calories above what is needed to accrue muscle tissue is just going to be partitioned towards being stored in adipose tissue. As if we really think about it from a physiological process perspective, gaining fat is far easier and quicker than gaining muscle is. So what I tend to do and what I prefer is to take an approach where I pair a progressive training stimulus with a small surplus that's enough to cover the energetic demands of a client's training, their training performance, the recovery, and then also making sure that we have enough protein intake from an energy perspective, but also from a dose perspective across the day to stimulate muscle protein synthesis. And all of these things are energetically costly processes that we need to optimize gains in lean mass while minimizing gains in fat. The topics of how fast we should gain, or a lot of times people will ask me, like, how fast should we gain weight during a muscle building phase? And with that, they'll ask me whether they should use a small surplus or a large surplus. And really, this is something that I've experimented with not only myself, but also with clients. And I've found if we really look at the research, we have yet to have one single study that shows a significant benefit to using a large surplus and taking an aggressive rate of gain to build muscle in intermediate or advanced trainees. And that's most of the people that are listening to this podcast. It's not people that just started in the gym. Now we do, and I want to put a caveat here, we do have some studies. There's a study by Reisenach for instance. It's a 2002 study where they do show that in untrained individuals, they can gain a lot of muscle by using a large surplus. But the caveat to those studies, and we always have to take this in consideration, is that when you are new to training, specific case, Rosnick, these were completely untrained individuals. You are highly sensitive to the stimulus of training. And also, their ceiling for muscle growth is so high that really all we're seeing in these studies is in these individuals making their newbie gains, which is something we've all experienced. So it isn't something that can be applied to guys at our level. And so when we actually look at the research, and I'll take this through what we had prior to Eric Helm's study, and then also how this ties in with Eric Helm's study. But when we really look at like the evidence that we have on well-trained individuals, we do not see that large surpluses yield greater gains in lean mass. So for example, there's a 2019 study, I believe, and it's by Ribeiro and colleagues. And what they did was they took competitive bodybuilders and they split them up into two groups. They had a large surplus group and a moderate surplus group. And they found that within the large surplus group, they gained 2.4 kilograms of fat-free mass, whereas the moderate group only gained 1.2 kilograms of fat-free mass. So when we look at it just from a fat-free mass perspective, yes, the large surplus group gained double the amount of fat-free mass. However, when we look at the amount of fat that each gained group gained, we see the drawbacks of using a large surplus with advanced trainees, as the large surplus group gained 1.8 kilograms of fat mass, while the moderate surplus group gained only 0.3 kilograms of fat mass. So although the large group gained twice the amount of fat-free mass, they also gained six times the amount of fat mass in that process. Then if we go back just a few years previously, and this is probably the most famous study that we have on rates of weight gain and sizes of surplus on trained individuals, we have a study by Garth, which I'm sure both of you guys are familiar with. And in this study, what they did was they put elite athletes onto a progressive resistance training program and split them into two groups. So they had a large calorie surplus group and then what they considered an ad libitum group. So the large calorie surplus group, you know, ate about, I believe it was like 600 calories over maintenance, whereas the ad libitum group ate what ended up equating to 200 or 300 calorie surplus. And really what they were doing was they told them to eat ad libitum, which is just a term for eating to fullness. So it wasn't like they were force feeding themselves or stuffing down calories like in the large surplus group, essentially. And by the end of the study, they found that both groups gained a significant amount of muscle mass, but the large surplus group gained five times more fat and two times more body weight, with almost all that body weight coming from fat mass as compared to the small surplus group. So in both of these studies, we see that using large surpluses in trained individuals leads to either slightly greater or the same amount of muscle gain, essentially, but yet five times or more the amount of fat gain, which is something that none of us or any of our clients want to experience. Now, in addition to those, we can go into the Eric Helm study, which was recently released at the end of 2023. So it was originally a preprint when we first got this question, but it was just, I believe in December, it was actually officially published. And so in this study, they looked at the effects of different energy intakes and states of energy balance and their impacts on muscle gain, on strength gain, and skin fold thickness. And this was a really great study design because they did use resistance trained individuals. And what they did was they split them into three different dietary conditions. So we had a maintenance group, a moderate surplus group, and a large surplus group. So essentially, they had one group that was labeled as maintenance, which ate at maintenance calories, and they tried to stay within 1% of their body weight. Then they had the moderate group, which were put into a small surplus and assigned an energy intake target that was supposed to be a 5% surplus, which we'll go through later, but they didn't end up hitting that 5% surplus, but that was the intended surplus. And really what they were trying to do was gain at a rate of 0.2 to 0.3% per week. So over the course of a month, that would be between 0.8 to 1.2% rate of gain of body weight gain per month. And then they had another group that was labeled as the high group. So this was essentially a large surplus group that was given an energy intake target of 15% over their maintenance. So if their maintenance calories were 3,000, that would be going up to 3,450 calories. So a 450 calorie surplus. And they were supposed to increase their body weight by an average of 1.4 to 1.6% every 2 weeks. So this was an aggressive surplus. Now, throughout the entire 8-week study, there was a lot of control within this condition. So they were guided by a nutritionist throughout the entire intervention. They also had them come into the lab three times per week and complete a full body resistance training program where guys like Eric were actually watching them train. So then what's really interesting about this is when we look at the body weight change at the end of the 8 weeks, the maintenance group gained about a pound, so they stayed within their maintenance range. Now, the moderate group and the large surplus group actually gained the same amount of weight on average, which means that some of the individuals in the moderate group actually ate in a larger surplus, and some people in the large surplus actually ate in a more moderate deficit. So there was some variability in terms of responses. And so this doesn't mean that everyone within the moderate group ate in the large surplus, But on average, both groups gained the same amount of weight because some in the moderate group ate a little bit more and some in the large surplus group ate a little bit less. And there's also different aspects that could have come into the equation. So some people could have had an adaptive metabolism, meaning they could have upregulated their NEAT levels or just dissipated some of that extra energy. So they could have been in larger surplus, but because of their upregulations and different aspects of their total daily energy expenditure, they could have burned off more calories and made it look like they were actually in a slight or moderate surplus. Now, when we look at the actual differences in muscle, what we end up seeing is that all three groups saw growth in their quads, their biceps, and their triceps. And on average, there was really no significant differences in gains between groups. So even the group that was eating at maintenance made similar gains. Then when we look at strength, those in the larger surplus and in the high surplus group, they made better bench press gains. But the most significant finding that we actually have from this study is the differences in the sum of skin fold thicknesses, which they use as a proxy for body fat. And what they found in this was they actually saw the sum of the skin fold thickness go down in the maintenance group. They went up in the moderate group, and they went up even more on average in the high group. So those in the small and the large surplus gained more fat than those in the maintenance, which was to be expected if we think about it from an energy intake perspective. So what they found was that when intermediate and advanced trainees go into an 8-week training study, which we have to always caveat this to this study design. So it was 3 days per week. They weren't using a ton of volume. There was one slightly significant finding where they saw that if you gained more body weight, you were more likely to gain bicep thickness, but also the biggest correlation that they saw within this entire study was that the more weight you gain, the quicker of a rate of gain that you utilize, the higher the sum of your skin fold thickness, which really means the quicker you gain weight, the larger surplus that you utilize, the more fat you will gain over a period of time, especially when you're intermediate or advanced. We won't see an expedited rate of muscle growth because really when we look at it, there is not a significant difference being seen between being at maintenance, being in a 5% surplus, and being in a 15% surplus, because especially when we get to an intermediate level, the rate of change that we will see within an 8-week study period or 8-week training period is so small that really you're not going to advance that by just eating more. So the whole concept, we have to think about it as like a construct. And really what it comes down to it is the stimulus for increasing muscle tissue is your training. That is the primary and most robust stimulus for the adaptation of muscle growth. And then nutrition is permissive. It can help fuel that process and it can help accelerate that process. However, when we're looking at the context of a 3-day per week training intervention with low to moderate volume, if I can recall the study correctly, the only muscle group that got over 10 sets per week was the biceps, which indirectly got 18 sets. However, the rest of the body parts got 9 sets or less. And so when we really think about it, if we go back to 2017 Schoenfeld meta-analysis, we see that there's this differentiation in between gains. So 1 to 4 sets per week led to 64% of the gains. 5 to 9 sets per week led to 84% of the possible gains. And then 10 plus sets per week led to 100% of the gains. So what we see is that the only muscle group that was getting an optimized training volume on average, when we look at the meta-analytic data, was the biceps, and they were the most likely to grow. But the most significant finding was when you push a surplus and you push an accelerated rate of gain, especially in a compressed time period, because all three of us would attest to the fact that 8 weeks is not a significant enough period of time to really gain a substantial amount of muscle. So for instance, I'm 8 weeks into my building phase currently. I'm already at the 8-week point. I've already completed 8 weeks. I've gained 2% of my body weight. Now, these individuals were aiming for a much higher rate than that in the large surplus group. And what they really saw was an expedited rate of fat gain. So that's really the most substantial finding out of these. So if we look at Ribeiro, if we look at Garth, if we look at Helms et al. 2023, all these studies really lead us into what we're already seeing in practice. Because I'll tell you, there have been individuals that I've worked with that they want to push as quickly as possible. And they really think that they can just eat more and they're going to gain tissue. And it's like, you can only gain tissue. It's a physiological process that's slow in nature. This isn't like fat loss. We cannot take the rates of loss that we utilize. So say, for instance, we start a fat loss phase and we might be targeting 1% rate of loss per week. You cannot reverse that and say, all right, now I'm going to gain at 1% rate of gain per week. It just doesn't work like that. It's a much slower process. And you need to take your time because the rate at which you can accrue new muscle tissue is very slow. So with that being said, the closer that you get to your genetic ceiling or to the longer that you've been training, the more advanced you get, probably the slower the rate of gain you should utilize and the smaller the surplus you should utilize because your ability to accrue tissue becomes massively or significantly slower across time. Utilizing a higher surplus, it's not going to advance your ability to gain tissue. It's going to advance your ability to gain adipose tissue.
Yeah, my takeaway too, and I'm glad you brought that up, was the training, right? I feel like we had talked about this before about how, hey, probably slower rate of gain is going to be better from a body composition standpoint. And you just, you obviously can't just force feed, but I thought it was cool that they did find that with the biceps, that those did grow, had a little bit more muscle growth. And I think really to me, what this told me was like, before you need to really worry about the surplus that you're in, you got to make sure training is in a good spot. If you're even going to try to like push that surplus, you really need to make sure you're pushing training. Otherwise it's like, you're focusing on the wrong things there at that point. So that was a huge takeaway for me with the study. So I'm glad you brought that up. And I know, Jerry, you've had some posts, at least at some point, where it was like, hey, here's our things that we want to have before you get into a building phase. And I think that having that training, making sure you can really push your training, you need to make sure that's there before worrying about the surplus that you're in. But yeah, for my last couple building phases, I've definitely wanted to make sure I've cut back on the weight gain. I had a building phase when I was probably in college where it was just like, hey, I'm just trying to put on as much weight as I can. I want to be 230. I never got to 230, but I want to be 230 jacked. And it's like, dude, if I would have tried to do that, I just would have put on a bunch of body fat. I did. I got up to 190 and it was just a ton of body fat. But I do think it was good to do that one time to just force myself to gain weight. But now I obviously know that that's a bit too high. And then Jeremy and you had a building phase together a couple of years ago where I think we got me close to 180. And that was probably towards the end, maybe just a little bit more. I probably forced that weight gain a little bit more towards the end there. So I think with all this, you do it and then you go through a couple building phases, you see what weight feels good for you, what that rate of gain is, and then you adjust and whatnot there with that. So
yeah, that's a super interesting breakdown. Actually, what I have on the background of my computer is a social media post I was writing right before we hopped on. It was titled "Why Building at Maintenance is Generally Better Than Traditional Bulking Phases for the Women We Coach." And it's interesting to hear this as well. I think you guys really touched on the training and how important that is. And what I see for most people who start with us, I was talking about this the other day where I can think of one client who started coaching with us and it was like, you are already training as hard as I want you to. You're nailing this. And that was Natalie, right? Who's Jack. She's a coach on our team now. Whereas out of, again, it's probably been, man, close to 1,000 clients. That's the only example I can think of where I was like, yep, your effort is really there. And I think that so many people are like so quick to want to like hop into the surplus, eat more food. I think the idea of that is, of course, super appealing, but are missing the training intensity they need for that to really be productive on one end. Personally, I will say that like we work with a lot of women who will start in a place where, hey, you're already pretty damn lean. To change your physique more, we need to add more muscle, not get you leaner still. But oftentimes what I see is if we push you into a true, now we probably can like almost take a reverse diet approach where we'll see, yeah, we can rep more food and you're still feeling great. Body composition's holding well. We might see weight training up. Yeah. But again, we're not necessarily intentionally pushing like a surplus, definitely not intentionally pushing a large surplus. But I think for a lot of people, again, when we're too eager to, and that's, yeah, I used to do this a lot more where it's, hey, we want to see 0.25 to 0.5% of body weight gain every week right out of the gate to make sure that we're building tissue. Again, I will almost always, hey, until training is in a good place where you are consistently training hard for at least a few months, there's so much we can do with, hey, let's dial in your peri-workout nutrition. Let's improve again, like your training effort. And really see positive body composition changes there, where personally, at least an anecdote, I think that the surplus in the situation like that, which at least for us is where most people start coaching, which there are already people who have been in the gym and I think are also past that point of literally whatever you do works, right? Which I think is another important caveat, right? Where it's not like the, like we have the like walking on an incline treadmill for those people, like builds muscle, right? Where they're past that point. So we have to do things a little bit better, but again, we're not at the point where we're really like nailing the training, execution, and effort yet. Personally, I find it to be a little bit more productive to, again, let's do that at maintenance, let's dial in your peri-workout nutrition and things of that nature. I also, though, I honestly feel like a lot of times, like being too focused on the rate of gain is, I don't even know if throwing those numbers out there does that much good, because let's even look at my case. So like me now, I'm more advanced than I was a year ago. My rate of gain right now, Brandon, you are probably okay with that being a little bit quicker even than it was a year ago, despite me being a little bit more advanced, because there's all these other factors where I'm for sure gaining more tissue now than I was a year ago. But it's again, like all these other variables that I managed. Go ahead.
No, but there's another caveat to that. So like I alluded to with my own building phase, I believe in progressive overload in all aspects of life. And I know that you've actually come to me about this. And I actually heard you on podcast talk about this, that there's been mesocycles where you did not expect me to continue pushing you. But during our first fat loss phase, I pulled you back a lot. So I think one of the main roles as a coach is to know when to push a client and when to pull them back. Because oftentimes coaches need coaches because we need someone objective in our corner. We need someone to stop us from making the mistakes that we had in the past, but then we would do or continue to make mistakes going forward. And so during our fat loss phase, I was conservative with you. I got a lot of data on you. That was the first phase we went into. So everyone listening out there, Jeremiah was one of the only clients I've ever taken right into a fat loss phase. We had already a good working relationship.
So everybody going forward, Brandon will take you into fat loss phase.
No, you guys are going into a primer phase. So just keeping that in mind, but that's a little caveat. But when we went into a building phase, there was many weeks where I told you got more and I kept continue pushing you and I push you to your brink. And with that is going to come increases in calories to be able to fuel, to properly fuel and sufficiently fuel you for those training sessions. And also as you've gotten more advanced, you've also gotten much more accurate. You were good at training. So I don't want to disregard that, but there's actually been times. And I remember the first time you sent me a training video, you were like, I didn't expect you to give me that feedback. And I was like, you got more in you. You got a couple more reps. That was me being objective with you. This was what I thought you needed to hear. And that was me being honest and direct, but you've pushed yourself immensely hard. There's been a couple times where it's so funny because when you first started sending me videos, sometimes I'd be like, nah, he's got a couple more reps than you would expect. So you would give me your RIR targets or your estimations, and I would tell you what I thought they were. So we would go back and forth on this. And there's been a couple of times recently, you've been pushing yourself so hard that I'm like, I don't know if he's going to make that rep. And I'm like watching the video, I'm like nervous over here with the pendulum squat. And I'm like, I don't know if he's going to have to dump that. You've gotten so much more precise in terms of your execution. So we're at a point where I know that all of the, and here's the thing, it's not just about body weight gain per week. So it isn't just about one variable, it's about everything. Right. Is he nailing his supplementation? Is he nailing his nutrition? What is his consistency like? What is his biofeedback? What was his health metrics like? You know that at any point, and we've discussed this many times, we just had lab work on you. I was immensely happy with your lab work this round. So I'm not concerned with continuing to push at the rate that we're going. However, if there were abnormalities, which there have been after fat loss phases in terms of your stress hormones and things of that sort, I've been the first person to say, listen, we have to have a conversation about this. We need to dial in more stress adjunctive therapies to help with stress mitigation and things because reverse T3 is very high or cortisol is very elevated or things are out of range. And so really, I think it comes down to the person that you're working with, and we can't take a blanketed prescription. So if you guys notice, yes, I do know the evidence-based rate of gain targets. I know them off the back of my head, as do we all. However, I don't think that applies to everyone. And one thing I do want to follow up on is actually, I genuinely, and I understand that this might not be a common thing for people to say, I genuinely think that most women recomp are more likely to recomp than men are. And I can give you many facets for that.
First, I was going to say that as well, actually. Go on.
And you and I cover this on our women's fat loss series that we did. And so really I see, and I'll tell you from my own personal experience, when I put women into a primer phase where I get them back up to maintenance. So generally with the clientele that I work with, they're coming from a long dieting history. They're chronic dieters. They've been underfueling themselves. So when I dial in their peri-workout nutrition, I get them fueling themselves sufficiently, not only from an energetic perspective, but also I switch them from a mindset of essentially restriction and subtraction to abundance and addition. So we're adding protein intake. We're adding peri-workout nutrition. We're adding a pre-workout meal rather than training fasted. I'm really switching them from like this circuit style training or CrossFit or these bootcamp classes to progressive resistance training program that's programmed and that's very structured and that has a progression method in place. When I get them to think about what their body can do from a performance perspective on getting better on a week-to-week basis, whether that be by rep progression or load progression, everything starts to get them into a state where they're very adaptable to the training stimulus and also to the nutritional intake that they're taking in. And I watch women morph. Like, they are so adept, and I think it comes from multiple perspectives. So I'll give you guys like the theories, and I've looked into the research on this, and we do see there is actually a lot of body recomposition research on women, even dating back to the 90s, which a lot of people overlook. However, first and foremost, women have a higher essential amount of body fat than we do. So generally, most women that work with us are going to have higher body fat levels, more endogenous stored body fat than men are. So they're going to be able to pull more from stored body fat to use and oxidize as energy. Second of all, most women are under consuming protein. So that is one lever that we can pull. Whereas most guys that come to us are already eating 1 gram per pound. So it's not like we have a lot of levers to pull on that. Another thing is a lot of women have not been ingrained into a culture where resistance training and progressing your resistance training is something that they're either interested in or have become indoctrinated into. So a lot of women, they're hesitant. And I'll have these conversations with clients where it's like, they won't want to be training, like sweating, really pushing themselves. And then they go from that mindset of just wanting to look cute in the gym to like really pushing themselves and becoming a badass. And now they're like beating the guys in the gym, or they're working out with their boyfriends and they're beating their rep PRs or really burning them because they have such good work capacity. And then we combine that with a new mindset around fueling themselves properly and around checking off the boxes from a nutritional intake perspective. Instead of going large bouts of the day without eating and suffering from within-day energy deficiency, now they're well-fueled throughout the course of the day. And even at maintenance, they're able to make insane progress, especially when they start believing in themselves and they start treating themselves in a manner where they don't want to just become smaller and essentially a skinnier version of themselves. They want to become a leaner, better, more muscular version of themselves. And so that switch, both from a nutritional perspective, a training perspective, and then a mindset perspective, puts them in this advantageous position to really morph at maintenance, to be honest with you. And with a lot of women, I find that to be the best intervention to start them out with, because a lot of times they are hesitant. So if they come to you with a dieting history and they are so used to only cutting calories and trying to be a smaller version of themselves and always trying to eat less, and you tell them, listen, we're not only going to go to maintenance, I'm going to take you all the way into a surplus. It's like they're not buying into that process, and you lose them right off the bat. If you can get them buy in and show them that they could really advance their body by giving themselves, I always tell the women that I work with this, you need to give your body what it needs to get your body to do what you want it to do. So if you want a better physique, you need to fuel it in a manner that it's going to be able to recover and adapt to the training that you're putting upon it and the stimuli that you're essentially exposing itself to. And so really when it comes down to it, a lot of women can make amazing progress in maintenance. And the only downfall of this study, and it's nothing against Helms and the rest of his colleagues, it's that it didn't have a lot of women in this study. And I think that they would have seen even like the maintenance group, I'm not saying it would have went above and beyond, because this is a randomized control trial. So essentially what they do is they randomize the group. So we couldn't have said we're going to put a bunch of women in maintenance and then the men in a small or large surplus. But if we were to think from our own coaching experience and we were to look at how many women we can get to build muscle at maintenance as compared to the men that we have building muscle at maintenance, I guarantee, and I'll tell you from my own experience, I'm going to have more women that I can have recomp and build muscle at maintenance than I do men. And that's just because of the demographic that I attract and the experience that I have working with women as compared to men. And so I think that there is multiple roads to Rome. And I think we see that with all aspects of training, nutrition. There's many avenues that we can take to optimize someone's path. And we really have to take an individualized approach. So for some, the best and most conducive approach to gaining muscle is to not focus on weight gain at all, is to focus on fueling themselves, on bettering their performance, and seeing and switching from a mindset of becoming a smaller version of themselves to seeing what their body is capable of from a function and performance standpoint. And that's what I would do with women. And then for some men, it's like, listen, you've been tapped out for years. I'm going to have to see your body weight gain, because Jeremiah, we did try to do like a recomp at one point where we try to keep your weight around the same, but you weren't making as much progress. We were, and I'll take full ownership for this. I told you initially, I think we can recomp right here. And then I realized, and I told you, I said, listen, I got to bump up the energy intake because we were staying stagnant. And we obviously have been through many phases. So there was one building phase, our initial building phase, you hit a cap in terms of your appetite. And then I reeled things back. And then we were able to slowly and more strategically, because I had so much more data on you, titrate up calories much slower, but your rate of gain was much more consistent. So we pulled back on the bottleneck. We bought you some more runway. And honestly, since then, man, you've made phenomenal progress. Your body weight's much higher, but you're in better condition. You're also having much better biofeedback from an appetite, digestion perspective. Your training performance is just flying. So it's like we have all these, there's many things that we have to make sure are going in the right direction. And it's almost like we're trying to get multiple aspects. We're trying to make sure nutrition's dialed in, training's dialed in, the progression, the gym's dialed in. But if you only have one of those, so for instance, if your training is shit, but you're going to eat in a surplus, it's like, good luck, you're gaining fat. If you only have the training and you're under fueling yourself, you're diminishing or you're hindering your ability to gain muscle. And so we have to have all these things working together and really moving in a forward progression, which is why I allude to the fact that I believe in progressive overload of all things. So that's progressive overload of the training stimulus, of your nutritional intake, your mindset and your approach to training, how you get dialed in. We even had an episode, which was a couple podcasts ago, where we spoke about how we approach training in terms of getting dialed in. I even spoke about how I progress, even my usage of supplementation. So in week one of a mesocycle, I use very low caffeine, or I'll utilize a non-stimulant pre-workout like Legion Athletics, pre-workout. And then at week four, week five, week six, I'm cranking caffeine, guys. I'm making sure I have music blasting through the roof. When in week one, I'm listening to a podcast. So it's like we undulate things, we progress things, and it's a periodization of all things: nutrition, training, body composition progress, supplementation, even external stimuli like music and things of that sort.
Yeah. And then you touched on something interesting there as well. I was going to say this also. I'm glad that you validated this, because you explained the evidence behind it much better than I was just going to speak from anecdote. But I do typically with men find that it is more productive to push for, again, there are a lot of variables here, but I typically find like that is where I will more often push for, hey, I do want to see you gaining a little bit more quickly. I do want to see more of the specific rate of gain, where it's so much less frequent that I'll do that with women. So that was interesting. You touched on that as well, because that was one of the things that I wanted to mention.
And it makes sense too, that like you said, part of it could be, hey, they have a little bit higher levels of body fat overall too. And then I think there's also the myth too, that women are going to be like slower when it comes to muscle growth too. But from my understanding, that's not true. We're going to gain the same amount. I think the only time it might be different is like during puberty when testosterone starts kicking in and things like that. But otherwise it's like women can gain muscle just as quick as guys can as well too. Brandon, you look like you want to say something.
Actually, there's a great review on that by Roberts et al. In 2020, and they saw that, they found that the muscular potential, the maximum muscular potential of women was actually equivalent to men. And really what we see is, on an absolute basis, we see that men gain more weight and gain more muscle mass. So on an absolute basis means if a man started at 70 kilograms or 150 pounds and a woman started at 110 pounds, guys, don't mind me because I go back and forth with different metrics because I'm so used to talking to international clients. But say that we have a woman that starts at 110 pounds and she gains 10% of skeletal muscle mass. And you just hypothetically, let's just say that becomes 11 pounds. If a man starts at 150 pounds and he gains 10% of body weight, he's up 15 pounds. So on an absolute basis, a man's always, due to starting body weight, they're always going to be larger on average. However, when we actually look at the relative increase, if we see an intervention, so there's a study by Hubel et al. It's a 2005 study, and they saw that there was massive variability in terms of gains in both muscle and strength. But on average, women and men had the same variability in responses. So that means within the same subset of the same gender, we're seeing that there's a large variance between all females and then all males. However, when we look at it on a quantitative basis, so the Roberts paper, I believe it's Brandon Roberts is the main author, and I'm almost sure that Greg Knuckles is on that paper. And they found equivalent muscle gains in a relative basis, so that if in an intervention, they saw a 10% increase in muscle mass, and this is just a hypothetical number, but say they saw a 10% increase in one intervention in the men in that study, they also saw a 10% relative increase in women. And really what it comes down to is we have the same muscular potential. There's some older reviews that actually showed that women had up to 85% of the muscular potential as men, but more recent reviews show that it's much more equivalent. So it's very, very close in terms of your actual ability to gain muscle. However, I think the reason that we don't see that in the real world is because A, people aren't thinking about it in terms of the relative basis. So they're not like, all right, this woman started training and she was 50 pounds lighter than her boyfriend. And so, yeah, if she gains 10% muscle and he gains 10% muscle, it's going to be a large discrepancy due to their difference in body weight. But also think about how many women aren't pushing themselves really to gain muscle. And so it's the outliers that we work with. I've worked with women all the way up to the women's physique, the IFBB women's physique pro stage. So I've seen very muscular women that are more muscular than I am. And all three of us on this call. And then there's other women that come to me and they have a very low training status. And so they have a much larger room for improvement. So we really have to take into consideration that it really is based. So I don't want to say this. Yes, you have the same potential as men do, but you can decide to maximize that potential or not. And so what I really want to get across to women, and this is a conversation I'm sure Jeremiah has often because I have this often, it's, listen, you're not going to turn into a male because we see that men even struggle with gaining muscle. So imagine you, that you have not stacked all the decks and all the cards in your favor. It's going to take you a lot longer to get to where you want to be. And so don't think about it as like this dichotomous thing where if you train like you want to gain muscle, you're going to become manly looking, because that's generally not going to happen. And most of the men that have been training their whole lives are still not as muscular as they want to be. And you, on an absolute basis, aren't going to gain as much muscle as they have onto your frame. So if we really can contextualize that, like, you can attain the body that you want, you have all the potential in the world. So if you want to maximize it and you want to become the most muscular woman on the face of the earth, by all means, just keep in mind that most of those women that do that are enhanced. So we have to take that into consideration. But at the same time, if you want to just gain a significant amount of muscle, that's going to improve the shape of your physique. You're going to become more toned, more tight. You're going to develop better glutes and better delts, and you have a more shapely physique. You can do that just as well as a male can, but you will just not be as big as a male will be. So you get exactly what you want in terms of improving your shape, your physique, but you're not going to have this over masculinized, androgenized look. And so that's, we have to dispel some of the common perception and myth, but also allow women to realize that you have all the potential that a man does. You just haven't been training as long. You haven't been putting as much effort into this, and you haven't really been putting all your ducks in a row. And when you do, you can have an immensely great response. And that's something that I've seen with many of the women that I've worked with. And we've been able to get to the physique they want over an extended period of time.
Yeah. And so, like you said too, I think it's like a lot of times people confuse, oh, hey, I weight train or I lift weights, whether that be just, it's like circuit based or whatever it may be. It's like, they're also not, just because you're weight training doesn't mean you're maximizing muscle growth and changing your physique with that training. The kind of small variables do really add up and are super important when it comes to building muscle too there with that. Cool. Jerry, I know you got to hop off, man. So I guess we'll kind of end this now. Did you have anything else you wanted to add to this topic or anything like that?
I don't think so. Great conversation. It was great to catch up with you guys. I think that was a great topic though.
Yeah, absolutely. Always love talking about weight gain. I know we had this on the docket for at least the last couple ones. So, we were just waiting until it got officially published.
What's funny about this is it was a preprint before we got this out. I will say something. In the preprint, there was actually some incorrect information about it, just how they had released it. And I know Eric has spoken about this, obviously, overtly. I'm going to have him on my podcast actually next week, which is why I was very familiar with the topic, because I've been obviously researching it for this presentation that I'm doing, but also because I'm going to be having Eric on in the next couple of days. However, when they originally released the preprint, they had mixed up two of the groups. And so I believe they said the moderate group had actually gained or had increased their bench more than the high surplus group. And now they've obviously revised it, but there's a lot of people that jump right on the preprint. And this is something that I've learned in all things in life. And we've had these conversations off air about other trends and patterns that I haven't jumped on or haven't spoken about openly, because I'm like, listen, I really want to wait till the evidence bears out and really gets substantiated. So if one study comes out on a topic, I'm generally not going to cover it unless there's a ton of data before it. So a great example of that is there was a Tromelin study on protein metabolism and 100 gram dose of milk concentrate. Dr. Scott Stevenson and I recently did a deep dive into that, but that's because we have 20 years of protein metabolism work that shows different findings, and there was a substantiated body of evidence to work off of. But in this exact study, there was a lot of individuals that made content about this. And if you go back to their content and you hear what they're talking about the study, they're incorrect because they went off a preprint that was not peer reviewed. So this is just a little bit of a heads up to those that create evidence-based content. Always wait for the study to get published to really find the more refined version of a study, because a lot of times people jump on things, they'll make a social media graphic like deloads kill your gains or all these hot takes, and you didn't even wait for that study to be published. You misinterpreted it and you misled your audience.
Absolutely. Hey, real quick, Brandon, I do want to chat with you about that real quick, but Jerry, I know you need to hop off, so I don't know. I just want to be respectful.
Yeah, I'll hop off, but thank you guys. Great to catch up, and I'll talk to you guys soon.
Cool. See you, Jerry.
Peace.
On the protein, what were some of those findings there that you found that were people got wrong from the preprint to the actual?
So wasn't that it was a preprint, it was published. However, what a lot of people got was a misperception of things. So first and foremost, the Tromelin et al. study, it's a 2023 study. And what they really found was that a 100-gram dose of milk protein concentrate, now keep in mind, most, if not all the data that we have on protein is on whey isolate. It's a different protein kinetics, a different digestion rate. So what they did was they used stable isotope tracers. So essentially, they looked at this over a continued period of time of 12 hours. And so they looked at a 100-gram dose, a 25-gram dose, and a 0-gram dose. And they took recreationally active individuals who were untrained. They exposed them to, or they put them through a full-body resistance training program. And then they had them either consume 100 grams of milk protein concentrate, 25 grams of milk protein concentrate, or a placebo group that was 0 grams of protein, milk protein concentrate. And what they found was that all areas or all aspects of protein synthesis were elevated higher and longer in the 100 gram dose group. So what a lot of people on social media came out and said was, this validates intermittent fasting, or you only eat protein once per day, or whatever it may be. Now, here's the thing. First of all, we have to think about the fact that these are new resistant trainings. So we actually see that there is not a correlation between acute rises in muscle protein synthesis and longitudinal increases in muscle mass, meaning that we have a DeMoss study 2016, which shows that we do not see a correlation between increases in muscle protein synthesis until after a 3 to 6 week acclimation period to training. Because generally what we see is when someone is new to resistance training, the novelty of that training stimulus induces a large muscle damage effect. So we see muscle protein breakdown elevate so much that those massive increases in muscle protein synthesis are essentially just being utilized as recovery resources to repair that damage, so the damaged tissue, but they're not being allocated towards actual muscle accretion, so the addition of new muscle proteins in contractile tissue. So a lot of people took the findings of the study. Now, keep in mind, when we actually look at the increases in muscle protein synthesis, the title of the study is something in terms of there is no upper limit to the magnitude or the threshold of protein intake. Here's the thing. They only tested 100 grams and 25 grams. So you can't say that we've never found an upper threshold when you haven't tested above that. Yes, 100 grams did elevate muscle protein synthesis, myofibrillar protein synthesis, and plasma protein synthesis higher than 25 grams. However, if you actually look at, and this was, and all the credit goes to Dr. Scott Stevenson, who's a great friend of mine. He actually looked at the actual statistical values of these things. And what he found was that there's other studies that have shown much higher protein synthetic responses. So myofibrillar protein synthesis, which is the actual protein synthesis that allows us to add muscle protein to actual skeletal muscle tissue. We have other studies looking at smaller doses. So a 48 gram dose of study from, or a 48 gram whey protein isolate dose from like a 2005 study showed almost double the increase in myofibrillar protein synthesis rates as this 100 gram dose. Now, what they're showing is, yes, there was a higher elevation in the 100-gram dose than the 25-gram dose, but we're looking at a milk protein concentrate, so the kinetics are going to be much slower, because think about that. When you look at milk protein, the actual composition of that is 80% casein, 20% whey. So it's different than a whey isolate. All the other research that we have, a lot of people are utilizing this as proof that we can digest and absorb more than 20 grams of protein at a sitting. Here's the thing. We've always known that. So when we really think about it from like an actual foundational perspective, we have multiple areas of literature that look at whey isolate as well as different whole food protein sources that find that you'll get a higher elevation of muscle protein synthesis over 20 grams. The original study that showed that 20 grams was a cap was a study by Moore et al. 2009, which looked at new young trainees. They were like 20-year-old college-age students that did three sets of a leg extension, or it was like just like a lower body workout. And they showed that 40 grams did have a higher elevation in protein synthesis, but it was just fractionally better. So they looked at a 5, a 10, or 0, a 5, a 10, a 20, a 40 gram dose. The biggest elevation or biggest difference they saw going from 10 grams of protein post-workout to 20 grams of whey isolate. But if you actually look at the charts and the graphs, between 20 and 40, it's still going up. It's just asymptotic, essentially. So that means that it's not statistically significant. So what they said was 20 grams was enough to maximize the protein synthetic response post-training. However, when we look at McNaughton et al., which is a 2016 study, they did a full body resistance training program, and they actually did it based off of individuals' lean body mass. So they wanted to check, and this is one of the only studies that have done this, does your level of lean body mass, so the amount of muscle tissue on your frame, influence how much protein you need? And they looked at different doses of whey isolate, and they looked at both a 20 and a 40 gram dose. And in all individuals, whether they had low lean body mass or high levels of lean body mass, 40 grams had a more profound effect and a higher elevation in muscle protein synthesis post-workout. We also have multiple studies out of a lab by that's run by Dr. Bob Wolf that has showed that 70 grams of different proteins, so these are whole food proteins, generally beef protein, actually lead to slightly better or slightly higher rates of muscle protein synthesis and lower rates of muscle protein breakdown. So in the net protein synthesis or net protein balance, you have a better net protein balance at even 70 grams as compared to 40 grams in one study. And in another study on older adults, they found that 70 grams led to better muscle protein or higher protein muscle protein synthesis elevations and lower muscle protein breakdown elevations in elderly individuals. So really what this study comes down to is a lot of people are extrapolating this out to be, this is the end all be all for protein metabolism. This is the first study to disprove the 20 gram dose. And it's like, we have so much other research that has come out before this that shows that we can utilize more protein. And the other misconception is there has never been a digestibility limit to protein. What you digest or what you take in is what you digest. Now, the biggest misconception, and this is the same thing as like when we talk about the concepts of fat loss. You'll hear people say, I'm oxidizing body fat, or you go on a ketogenic diet, you're going to increase your fat oxidation levels. And we see that in research. So if we look at respiratory exchange ratio, if you go on a high fat diet, you'll generally burn more body fat, or if you're at lower, or you'll burn more stored fat, essentially. Body fat oxidation or fat oxidation is not fat loss. We have to look at negative fat, being a negative fat balance. So if you overconsume calories and you're in a surplus and you're going on a keto gains diet, you're eating in a keto bulk, you are oxidizing more fat, but you're not losing body fat. Those are two different concepts. And that's the same thing with protein digestibility and protein synthesis elevations. And so really within this study, Dr. Scott and I did over a 90-minute podcast on this, where we went through all the different research on this. And then also he went through really a very in-depth breakdown of all the protein kinetics. He's very well-versed in obviously doing these studies. They utilize muscle biopsies and things of that sort. And that's something that he's done within his PhD work. And so it was just a really interesting take, because there's a lot of research that comes out And someone will jump on the first, it'll go up on Twitter or X at this point. And a researcher will tweet this and say, this is my latest study. And then we see evidence, quote unquote, evidence-based practitioners in our field. And before they even had the chance, and it's only practical because I'll tell you, I reviewed the Tromblin study a couple of weeks ago before Dr. Scott and I sat down, and it took me like 3 or 4 hours to read it. And I even missed parts, to be honest, that Scott brought up, because he actually went into the supplementary files. He went into the extra databases that they had, and he went through all the resources. So he took 6 or 7 hours. I took 3 hours to read the study. And it's funny because the study will get released, and the next day someone has like a full carousel on the study. And it's like, their findings or the content they're putting out, they're trying to be the first at bat. And I understand that there's a sense of urgency in the social media era where you want to put out content because you get a hot take out on the internet and everyone reshares your stuff. But a lot of times it can almost be misleading. And there's a lot of, I have an immense amount of respect for researchers, but I also, the biggest thing that I try to do, and I think you know this about me, is I really try to take research and information and blend that side and really get us into the realm of translating research and information to practical application. And if you misconstrue the findings of a study and you try to put that out, you're influencing people in a, I don't want to say a negative light, but you're misconstruing data and also having them misinterpret the findings of these studies as well. And so as individuals that have experience, whether it be in research or for us, like we're actual practitioners, like we have experience coaching and stuff, I take it with a great amount of responsibility. When I put something out there, I'm always very cautious of the information that I put out there, the way that I'll influence someone, or even the way that I answer questions. So there's been many times, and you know this very well, that we've gotten questions on these Q&As where they've wanted me to dissect someone's post or someone's, I'll never name any because I don't believe in bringing down someone else to bring light to something. But I will say that a lot of times, if I'm going to cover a study, I'm going to make sure I've reviewed it previously, or that I've spoken to the author themselves, or that I've actually done my due diligence, because I never want to misrepresent hard work that someone put into this research. So just like I gave the caveats with Eric's study, like he did the best he could in terms of COVID and the circumstances that we're in. I cannot wait to have him on our podcast. And I told him, listen, I want to cover this study on my podcast, but I want to have you on the podcast to do this. I've read through it, but I think the best person to do this would be yourself. So I look forward to having mom next week. And I just think for everyone out there, just be cautious when it's not the actual researcher themselves or someone that you know is really reliable with information. If you see a really hot take, there's just so many examples of this where it's like something sounds a little bit off, like you'll only have to eat protein once per day. But like the last 20 years, we've always been all the evidence-based practitioners, whether that be Alan Aragon or Brad Schoenfeld or Bill Campbell or all these other doctors in the space, all these other coaches have said, listen, it's probably most advantageous to at least get your protein in 3 servings per day. We have mechanistic studies on muscle protein synthesis from Arete et al. We have Mamoreau, which looked at different protein distribution in terms of whole food meals. And then we also have a Yasuda study that's in trained individuals where it was a longitudinal study where they found that over the course of, I want to say 8 to 12 weeks, those that had an even protein distribution over 3 meals as compared to a skewed distribution, which it would be what the average American does. They underconsume protein at breakfast. They have a very low protein breakfast, a medium protein lunch, and then a very large protein dinner. Like if you have a steak at dinner, they found that even though calories and protein were equated between groups, those in the even distribution group, now keep in mind, both of these groups were under consuming protein in totality. So I believe the average in the even group is 1.3 grams per kilogram. In the skewed group, they actually had a little bit higher. I want to say it was 1.45. So still under the evidence-based consensus of 1.6 to 2.2 from the Morton 2018 meta-analysis that indicates that is the sweet spot for optimizing gains in lean mass. However, even with that skewed distribution and those lower protein intakes, the group that utilized an even distribution eating less protein per day actually gained over, I believe it was 2 pounds more over the course of those 12 weeks than the group that had a skewed pattern. So we have mechanistic data that's just in the lab looking at muscle biopsy, seeing higher elevations of protein synthesis. We have real world studies on people that don't train. Then we have longitudinal studies on people in resistance training interventions that show that 3 servings of even protein distribution per day are better than skewed distributions. Then if we also look at other longitudinal studies, we have other studies that look at 3 versus 6 meals per day, and we don't see an advantage between either of them. However, we have to keep in mind that there's a body of evidence for a reason, and we can't take one study and just run with it. As that's the same reason why, like, we went through the weight gain and I covered studies that preceded the new Eric Helm study, because I want to build off a body of evidence. We can't just take one study and really cement everything that we know based off that study, because even in Eric's study, he alludes to, if you actually go through like the discussion, he alludes to other research in this field that came before he designed this study with his research team. So it's really important that if we're going to pride ourselves on taking information and really trying to take the best available evidence and utilize an evidence-based approach, which combines the best of the body of evidence currently, the skills and our experience as a practitioner, or in this case, as us as a coach, and then also the preferences, the goals, the limitations, and the abilities of the client we work with. We have to consider all three. And that's really where it comes down to. When we answer your questions on this podcast, it's, listen, I'll tell you what the evidence says. I'll also tell you how I approach it with myself and my clients. And we all obviously opened up about that, but also it comes down to the client. So in the case of women, it's, if you don't want to gain weight and you're really opposed to that and you're not going to buy into the process, let's do it at maintenance.
Yeah, that's so really, I think with that protein study, it really just sounds the big thing is it just gives us a little bit more flexibility if you need it from 100%. Time to time. You don't necessarily need to stress all the time about that. However, it's still probably a good idea to, if you're trying to maximize muscle growth, hey, probably minimum of 3 servings per day when you can. But again, you have that flexibility if need be there. I know that obviously there's some limitations in terms of the ones that I came up with that I saw were like, obviously the population it was done in, again, is this going to be able to be translated over to like other sources of protein as well too? Is this going to be something that would last if they did it for multiple times? So definitely a lot of things that the study didn't answer as well too. So yeah, just be careful when you see people talking about the research, because there's a lot of ways you can misinterpret what they're saying. Cool, man. Appreciate your time as always. Already said goodbye to Jer. We'll obviously do this again soon, dude. And yeah, is there anything else you want to leave the audience with or anything like that?
Now, as always, guys, if you guys want to reach out to me, feel free to find me at Instagram, which is at BrandonDeCruz_, or my email, which is beautycruzfitness@gmail.com. Jeff, as always, it is a pleasure, my friend. Let's do this more often. I think this was 6 months. This is the longest time we've went.
It's been a while. Yep. We'll make sure we do it more often, man. Talk to you soon.
Peace.